First thing I want to say is just want to thank the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society for hosting this event, and in particular to Phil, Amy and Amir for all the work that they've done in setting up and organising this event. In a moment we're going to hear from Hugh Tomlinson about his experience and in the Leveson implementation and campaigning there. But before we hear from Hugh, Professor Dennis Gallagher would like to say a few words on behalf of the Foundation.
Well, thanks, Jake. Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Dennis Gallagher, Professor of Sociolegal Studies, and I'm also one of the founders and directors of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which we created 7 years ago. And our object in doing so was to try to provide the opportunity for exactly this kind of gathering today, that is to say a workshop which brought together academic and policy and lawyers and so on. So we really think that a lot of academic research in law and social science is available only to a very restricted readership. So our brief really is very much to try to make that research available through occasions like this, through publications on our website, and if you go to the website, Phil Dines, who is our communications officer, will give you all the details. And there are various publications from the Foundation over the last 7 years. We've had different programs. Courts and Public Policy was a prominent one. The Social Contract Revisited was another one, where we looked at the idea of a modern social contract as a lens through which to examine particular legal and social issues. More recently, we've had the social foundations of constitutions, and so on. But actually, we began, and it's interesting, we have quite a few Chinese guests here today, we began with a program on law and society in China. So it's rather nice to see we have some from the media side, law and media side, in the People's Republic. So that's really all I want to say. I hope it goes well. I hope it's a great day. And I'm going to hand over to Hugh, who's the substantive part of this procedure.
Good morning. I'm very honoured and delighted to be asked to make some opening remarks at this workshop. It's not billed as a keynote address, but I suppose it's what is traditionally called that. I'm afraid to say, going to give you a blow-by-blow account of late-night meetings in Ed Miliband's office in relation to the implementation of Leveson. I can tell you that nobody offered me any pizza, what I want to talk about is something more generally related to the title, Media Law After Leveson. There are many of my colleagues who bitterly complain to me that the short answer will be that there won't be any media law after Leveson, because as you will all know, the Leveson proposals involve setting up an arbitration system to deal with media law disputes. And the idea is, if the proposals work, if a self-regulator is established by the media, as is envisaged, there will be a popular, cheap and effective arbitral arm. Inquisitorial arbitrators will all but eliminate the need for lawyers, and the arbitrations will presumably largely take place behind closed doors, and media law will fade into history. You will perhaps... I realise it's not generally understood what the essence of the Leveson proposals are. The proposal is that media regulation be financed by taking money away from lawyers. The idea is that the large savings will be made on legal costs by the arbitration system, so less money will be spent on lawyers, and that money can be used to finance new, enhanced, and high-powered high-powered regulation. Commentators may not have noticed this, and academics may not have noticed it, but I can tell you many of my colleagues in the law have noticed it. I am, as a campaigner for the implementation of Leveson, a bit like the proverbial miner voting for Mrs. Thatcher. But what can be said about media law after Leveson? Well, the first point to make, it's an obvious one, but I think bears just some notice, is that Leveson actually says very little about media law. He makes 92 formal recommendations, of which seven concern changes to data protection law, which may be regarded as of some relevance to media law. I think there's one relating to police powers, and four concern changes to the civil law. Well, the data protection recommendations and those concerning police powers, as you may know, are going to be the subject of consultation. I think it's uncontroversial to say that, put at its lowest, they're unlikely to be implemented in full. I see there's a very interesting paper from David Erdos who's dealing with this later, and I'm not going to say anything more about it. The civil law recommendations are exclusively concerned with the law relating to damages. It's rather curious that two of them, concerning the extension of the scope of exemplary damages, have proved to be extraordinarily controversial. The fact is that when the Royal Charter and the supporting statute was agreed last month, those recommendations were in fact watered down. They were not adopted in their totality, and the exemplary damages were not extended in the way that Lord Justice Leveson recommended, and publishers were given an immunity which he did not recommend. But it's difficult. I'm sure everybody in this room will know the true factual position. The practical position is exemplary damages are of no importance whatever. The last case, I think, in which exemplary damages were awarded in a media case in England was in John in 1997, at the end of a trial which took place in November 1993, so nearly 20 years ago. Incidentally, for those who are impressed by the leaked media reports of the opinion of Messrs. Panic, Brown and White, in that case, the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Sir Thomas Bingham presiding, considered expressly the question of whether exemplary damages were compatible with Article 10 and decided that they were. Maybe that's something that the media think is an opinion that's out of date. I seems to me to be plainly the correct position. Now, that is the beginning and the end of Lord Justice Leveson's recommendations as they impact on directly on media law. But, of course, that's not the end of the story. And we know from the paper, the excellent papers that have already been circulated, that the focus is not so much on the narrow media law recommendations, but on the wider impact of the Leveson saga, if I can put it that way, on media law. It seems to me it's helpful to consider the Leveson inquiry as part of a battle, an important battle, but only not a decisive one, in a kind of media law culture wars. There has been, over the past decade or more, a clash between, you might say, two competing narratives as to what media law is all about. The popular view, if I can call it that, a view which is perhaps understandably to be found in the media, but also a view which politicians and a remarkable range of campaigners, and even, I have to say, some academics have been persuaded is true, is that English media law is uniquely oppressive of the media, and uniquely inimical to freedom of speech. Perhaps the most obvious example of this is the highly effective campaign to reform the English law of defamation, which tells us that English law, libel law, is chilling global freedom of expression by silencing writers, journalists, bloggers, human rights activists in the UK and around the world. That campaign, as I say, has been immensely effective. When the Prime Minister decided he would hold the defamation bill hostage over the Putnam Amendments, something which, rather surprisingly, the media did not blame him for, when he decided he would not bring it forward unless the Putnam Amendments concerning Leveson were removed, a distinguished group of writers were procured to write to the party leaders, saying that our libel laws are not just a national disgrace, but an international concern. The UN Human Rights Committee singled the UK out for the impact of libel of freedom of expression. The USA has introduced legislation to protect its citizens from our libel courts. Well, the short answer to that is of course, not quite. The position is, as I'm sure everybody in this room knows, that English libel law, far from being in any way exceptionalist, is rather boring and mainstream in terms of the common law world. Indeed, it's more favourable to the media than the law in several other common law jurisdictions. The place that the US are really protecting themselves against are the wicked Canadians who encourage libel tourism in a way that English lawyers can only dream about, have a libel law which is much less favourable, or has been traditionally, to the media. They've only very recently got a public interest journalism defence. And I always like to point out to people there are more libel, far from England being London being the libel capital of the world, there are more libel actions in New South Wales, which has a population of 7 million, than in England and Wales, which has a population of 56 million. The opposite view, as it were, in the media law war, what you might call the professional view, English media law has been has developed into an extraordinarily flexible and sophisticated instrument for the balancing of rights. I mean, I don't have time to go through all the important landmark cases, but if I could just mention perhaps three. First of all, there is, of course, the decision 20 years ago of the House of Lords in Derbyshire County Council to the effect that public bodies can't sue in libel, a decision which goes further than the Strasbourg jurisprudence. There is the decision of the House of Lords in Reynolds in 1997, developing, it's true, what is true to say, on Australian foundations, a new defence of responsible journalism or reasonable professional publication, whatever you'd like to call it. And then thirdly, perhaps without mentioning one particular case, there's been a series of cases over recent years which have adapted the common law doctrine of publication to the internet age, so that common law, really anybody who had any hand in the circulation of any material was a publisher, and what the courts have held is that to be a publisher, you've got to actually take an active role in the publication. You've got to have there's a kind of mens rea. Now that goes beyond the law in most other common law jurisdictions, and is very friendly towards towards online expression. There are, forgive me, there's one other case I've got to mention on my list. I see here is of course absolutely crucially the English courts in 1995 in the John case completely and radically limited the availability of damages for defamation at common law in a way that you don't find, to take an example of a country which is very friendly to freedom of speech, the United States. The damages in England are now limited in a way that I think you only find in the only country in Europe that does it is Greece. And you also find it in Australia, but English damages for libel are limited to a maximum figure, which is now, as of very recently, £300,000. So the old days of £1 million awards have gone. That in itself has perhaps been the biggest contribution to the tailing off of libel litigation in England over the past 20 years. So there is nevertheless a war between these two visions of libel law, and the reason for the reason why there's been such a war is perhaps obvious. Media law is a particularly the reason why there are contestations about media law and they're not contestations about, say, the law of contract or the law of trust is because media law is a site of a particular important conflict of power relations, because the power, the immense political power of media organisations is threatened by media, by restrictions that are laid down in the civil law. And that really brings us back to Leveson, because Leveson is really all about the power relations between the media and particularly politicians, but also, explicitly the police, but also generally about the way that the media exercises power. Now, in relation to the... I said I wasn't going to say a great deal about the process for the implementation of Leveson, but it's important to at least to note that despite everything that's said about the traditional media are losing their power, they're losing their influence, what matters now is what happens online. The last 4 months have seen the most remarkable power struggle between, on the one hand, those who supported Lord Justice Leveson's recommendations, which included a large majority of the public, as any all polls showed, a large majority of both houses of Parliament, and the support of every political party in the House of Commons, with the exception of Conservative ministers. Nevertheless, despite having such limited support, the print media have managed to conduct a campaign of outrageous and barely believable misinformation. Harold Evans described it as a campaign of staggering misinformation. Have managed to conduct this campaign and have managed to, at least for a long time, hold the opposition forces to fight them to a standstill. That the media continuing, contrary to Lord Justice Leveson's recommendations, continuing to enjoy privileged access to politicians in a series of secret meetings, have negotiated a series of dilutions to Lord Justice Leveson's recommendations, rather like after the trial, calling in the accused to the judge's chambers and asking the accused, you know, what sentence he fancied and whether he'd like to negotiate it down from 3 years to probation. I mean, that's effectively what the government did in inviting the media in after the Leveson report. But they have demonstrated that in this war, they still hold immense power. Leveson did not It's an interesting question for debate as to whether Lord Justice Leveson thought that by producing a report in the terms he did, he would in some sense spike the guns of the media barons and stop them exercising that immense power. I have a suspicion, and I don't claim any direct personal knowledge at all, but I have a suspicion that Lord Justice Leveson thought that his proposals were so eminently reasonable and so favourable to the media that they couldn't possibly argue with them. I'm afraid if that was the case, he was mistaken. Because what this is about, in the end, is the removal of power from a powerful social group. That's what media law does, and that's what the regulatory framework that Lord Justice Leveson recommended is intended to do. And of course, it's not surprising that British newspaper editors and proprietors who have exercised immense, wholly opaque and largely unexamined power for so long are fighting to resist any attempt to encroach upon that power. Now, I mentioned at the outset, not more than half seriously, the possibility that media law will be significantly changed if the new regulator comes into effect. At the moment, it remains an entirely open question as to whether the new regulator will come into effect. I was discussing this recently with, I'll describe them as a media insider, and I said, but what I don't understand is the media have effectively got everything they wanted from Lord Justice Leveson. They've got self-regulation. There is no statutory regulation. They have got a degree of independence which is unique in the British political system. What more do they want? And the answer was, what you've got to understand is their wounded pride. They feel that they have been beaten in this contest, and they feel because they've been beaten, they're not going to play the game anymore. And there is, it appears that certainly noises are being made that the media will not cooperate in the Leveson regulator, moderate and modest though it is proposed to be. It seems to me, I remain an optimist. It seems to me that in the end, the media will see, that the print media will see the good sense of cooperating with the regulatory framework that Lord Justice Leveson recommends. And I hope that they will take steps conscientiously to make it work. If they do, then it will change the scope of media law, the media law landscape. Very fundamentally, in two ways at least. The first I've already mentioned, it will put a lot of media law into arbitration rather than into the courts. Now that's not necessarily the death knell of media law. After all, there are large areas of commercial law which have traditionally always been the subject of arbitration, but then the courts, on appeal, deal with the subtle question of law. And if you look at decisions of the House of Lords going back 100 years, you'll find that they are decisions based on awards of arbitrators about matters which perhaps few in this room have any great interest in, but matters such as the operation of charter parties and other great commercial issues of the day. There's no reason why media law shouldn't be still considered by the courts, the difficult issues of law being examined. But secondly, and perhaps more fundamentally, the media law after Leveson will operate in a framework which will, if the system works, a framework which will include the decisions of a vigorous, independent and effective media regulator. The media finally admitted a couple of years ago that the PCC hadn't been a regulator at all, to be a complaints body. And the position is that the print media has never had a regulator of any kind. If a regulator is established, as Lord Justice Leveson envisaged, and if the newspapers do, as I say, as I hope they will, conscientiously take part, then we may find a whole body of regulatory decisions and regulatory case law developing, which will guide the question of the relation between media and society for the decades to come. That is what I hope will happen, and to reassure my colleagues who blame me for having campaigned to destroy their legal practices, I say as a very small crumb of comfort, well, look on the bright side, an effective and independent regulator will make decisions which are adverse to the media, and there'll be lots of judicial review challenges to fight over for the foreseeable future. So on that note of media law having moved from the Queen's Bench Division into the Administrative Court, but the same important and fundamental social issues still being debated in the courts, I will end. Welcome to this conference. I hope everybody enjoys themselves and a very good standard debate.
Okay.